Good evening and welcome to the North Oakland Speaker Meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. My name is Matt and I'm an alcoholic and tonight's secretary. Please turn off your cell phones. Please help me to open the meeting with a moment of silence followed by the serenity prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are fully self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. Does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. This is a speaker meeting. I will speak for 10 minutes and then turn the meeting over to our main speaker, Maddie, who will share her experience, strength, and hope.
Okay, I'm Matt. I'm an alcoholic. I'll start with the usual disclaimer. I have a sponsor, I have sponsees, I work the steps, do the 10 meetings regularly, got commitments, and I have a fellowship that I try to, you know, maintain frequent contact with. I grew up in Berkeley. I grew up in Berkeley, you know, and it sucked. I grew up in kind of your typical alcoholic family, drug addict, alcoholic dad, codependent mom, brother, running wild, you know. I was pretty, you know, I was a pretty bummed out little kid, you know. Depressed, didn't know how to handle life, didn't know how other people handled life. I felt isolated, I felt alone. I was bummed out, you get the picture. When I started drinking, I don't really remember what I was doing before I was drinking. But when I started, immediately, like, that's what my whole life started to revolve around. I mean, I didn't start drinking alcoholically at first, but I was still, like, I started to think alcoholically, you know what I mean? My first drink was, I was about, 12 or something, 12. I was hanging out at my friend's house. His parents had booze, and I was just like, you know what? We should fucking drink that shit. Like, I don't really know anything about it, you know? I know I'm not supposed to do it. So, yeah, we should do that, right? And he was not into it, you know? So we'd get in trouble, whatever, you know? So I was basically just like, fuck you, and drank his parents' booze anyway. Which was, I don't know, you know, kind of alcoholic behavior, right, from the get-go. And I got, you know, I didn't really know anything about drinking, so I think it was Malibu or something, just started chugging it, which is pretty much how I drank, you know, throughout my whole short little drinking career. I would always just get bottles and just fucking chug them to get drunk, you know, because I like the feeling or the effect produced by alcohol. I like to be drunk and I like to not have to deal with life, you know. I like to escape and I like to just, you know, whatever, feel good for once, you know, because life is such a bummer all the time. So I got drunk, ran around his house. Whatever, you know, he was bummed out about me. I didn't give a shit. I was drunk, you know. Who cares when you're drunk? Whatever. No big deal. That day came, it passed. You know, I started thinking more and more about drinking and doing drugs and other stuff. And, you know, over time, I guess it escalated. I started getting into harder drugs and started mixing a lot of things, doing opiates later on, which really kind of, you know, fucked me up. I probably, you know, later on, and probably when I was about 18, things really started to go downhill. It's probably when I started doing all the prescription painkillers and drinking all the time, you know. That was like my favorite combination. I didn't really care much that was like a deadly combination or whatever. I was just like, fuck it, you know, it's more effective that way, you know. I could stay fucked up longer for cheaper, you know, whatever. But I was losing my fucking mind, and I was suicidal. I wanted to kill myself. I tried to kill myself unsuccessfully, you know, and I just lived like, you know, I just didn't give a fuck about anything, you know. I lived suicidally, and I was drinking and using every day, and I was just really, really bummed out. And the funny thing is that while all this was going on, I didn't really think that I had a problem with drugs and alcohol, right? I thought it was crazy. I thought it was like fucking manic depressive or a unique little special flower or something. I don't know, you know? I didn't know anybody else really felt like me. So actually, I ended up in a therapist's office one day, and I was like, look, dude, you gotta give me some of your drugs. You gotta fix me. And, you know, I'll leave and, you know, go on about my life. You know what I mean? She's like, that's cool. Are you drunk right now? Because you were like, you seem drunk. Yeah, I was like, yeah, whatever. And she told me to come back later for another appointment. I did. Drunk again. Yeah, you know, I just couldn't do it. I didn't even understand how you did it. I was like, you know, I'm stressed out about this therapist appointment, so I have to drink, you know, because that's what you do. Apparently not, but that's what I did to get through tough situations like therapist appointments. Basically, she wasn't having it. She was like, dude, you maybe have a drinking problem, drug problem, whatever. I was like, whoa. Dude, I'm like schizophrenic or manic depressed. I'm something, you know what I mean? I was trying to like diagnose myself and shit. I'm not drug and alcohol, what? You know? I chemical dependency problems, that's not me, you know? Because, I mean, frankly, up until that point, you know, alcohol was always my solution, right, to me being maladjusted to life or whatever. I never really considered it the problem. So I ended up having to go to rehab, and at that rehab, it was like CDRP or something, Oakland CDRP. And to get through the phases, you have to go to AA meetings. So I did that reluctantly. And raised my hand as a newcomer. I didn't know really what that was or what AA was all about. I ended up going to a young people's meeting in Berkeley called College Bay. It's Thursdays, 8:15, on Durant or something. And, you know, immediately people just put their hand out and welcomed me into the fellowship and got my numbers. And they were really weird about it, too, like extra weird about it. Like, they were like, look, dude, I'm not hitting on you, you know. I just want your number. Like, they were really insecure about putting their hand out to me. I was just like, look, dude, I don't care what anything you're saying. I'm going to throw up. I'm kicking right now, you know. So that, you know, that's all I really remember from, you know, my first meeting. But the next day, one of those dudes called me up and was like, come to this meeting, you know? And that guy became my sponsor and just really showed me all about AA. And immediately I felt at home, you know, I felt like, you know, I wasn't alone anymore, which was, you know, not only did I feel alone in the world, but when I drank, I'd isolate, you know, I'd hang out in my room and just, I couldn't really handle other people. Because they would always, you know, they would be trying to drink your alcohol or your booze. They didn't know how to do it right, you know, and they'd waste it, and they didn't know how to, like, conserve, so you don't have to, like, get dope sick later, you know, or whatever. And so fuck people, right? But when I came to AA, I was like, oh, here's a bunch of people just like me, you know, I like these people, you know, so I started hanging out. You know, half-assing the steps and, you know, you come to meetings, we're kind of hanging out outside, you know, smoking cigarettes and just not, you know, I mean, I was coming, but I wasn't really doing the deal and, you know, I was relapsing a lot and I don't know, it took me a while to get it, you know, and I mean, I relapsed a lot, you know, and sometimes I would come to AA and then I would, you know, say I have some time, but then I'd be going home and just getting drunk or smoking weed or just because I didn't know what else to do with myself. I didn't know how else to live, you know. Eventually, that changed, you know. I don't know. Something changed in me. I hit bottom or something. I don't fucking know, you know. One day I just was like, you know what, I'm trying to do this. And I got a new sponsor that I was willing to listen to. And I got commitments. We started just fucking blasting through the steps. I started doing meetings, like, for real. Sitting through the whole one. And it really, you know, it really kind of changed my life for the better. And I'm really grateful that, you know, there's a solution to my problem, you know what I mean? A lot of people don't have solutions to their problems, and, like, fucking cancer, or AIDS, you know? Like, that's a bummer. Those are fatal diseases just like this one, but we can fucking, you know, we have something to do about it, you know what I mean? And I really try to keep that in mind. You know, especially when I'm like more relaxed about my program, is that, you know, I'm an alcoholic and I have a disease that will kill me or just will fucking, you know, deprive me of all any kind of happiness or peace in my life, you know, which is just as bad. But I can do something about it, you know, and I have a program that I can work, but I have to work it, you know what I mean? I have to put the initiative and you know, whatever, do all that, call my sponsor, work the steps, and, you know, be active, and not just fucking be like, whatever, this is something I, you know, this is like something that fucking, I don't know. Pretty much out of time, but whatever, you know. I just want to say one last thing. You know, I really, I try to keep things simple in my program. I'm definitely the alcoholic that thinks too much, you know, about, like, overanalyzes everything, and, like, God and higher powers, and, like, what does all that shit mean, and like, what is this fucking big book deal, and fuck Bill Wilson, he's an asshole, and, you know, like, whatever, and it's just, like, it's too much to think about, you know, one day I was just like, you know what, fuck this, I'm just gonna, like, you know, do I have a higher power in the steps, yeah, okay, do I, you know, am I working with others, yeah, do I have a fellowship, yeah, okay, I'm good, you know, whatever, as long as I have those things, I'm set, you know, and I feel like I'm doing good in life and in my program, so, yeah, that's it. Now I'd like to turn the meeting over to tonight's speaker, Maddie.
Hey, Maddie, I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Maddie.
Hey, Maddie. Thanks for sharing.
Thank you.
Welcome to everyone that's new. From down there, it looks like there aren't people all the way back, so it's scarier up here. I don't feel sober enough to do this right now, but this is a long time to talk and a lot of people to talk in front of, but I think I can handle it. My sobriety day birthday is February 11th, 2004. I'll be celebrating 8 years a week from today. I don't know where to start. It's always kind of an awkward thing, the whole blank page thing. I could actually really relate a lot to your share. I was introduced to alcoholism at a really young age too. When I was two, my parents split up, and my mom and I moved into a coke-infested apartment in Palo Alto. And I don't remember a lot from those times, but I stayed with her long enough to have witnessed a lot of her alcoholism. Of course, at the time, I didn't know that it was alcoholism. And when I was five, and she lost custody of me, I moved back. We had moved to Kansas City because the boyfriend who had infested our apartment with cocaine had broken up with her. So she moved back to her dad's. So I was living with three active alcoholics. My mother and her father and her stepmother. And so it was kind of like up until I was five, I had this life where my mom was a bartender, and so I was with her. She would pick me up from school, and then a babysitter would come over, and then she would go to work, and then she would get home around the time that it was time to take me to preschool. So I didn't really see her much other than the days that she wasn't working, and it sort of turned into a game. I learned at a really early age to ask what was in the clear glass with ice in it before drinking out of it. I don't know how old I was, but I was like toddling when I was like, is this vodka or water? Can I have some, please? And so that's what my life was like until I was five. And then she lost custody of me because she got in a drunk driving accident, a single car drunk driving accident, and so all of her friends were like, you know, like, Maddie needs to go back to her father, and so I moved back here to California, and so I went from this, like, you know, this thing, this life where, like, the vodka or water life, and where I thought that, snorting cocaine on the cuff of the coffee table was like something that grown-ups do, you know, like I didn't know what they were doing and I didn't know like why they were doing it, but it was just, you know, it was kind of like cooking breakfast or something, you know. And so I moved in with my dad and my stepmom, and there was this really awkward transition into this really normal life where, like, they both worked for Polo Ralph Lauren, and we lived in Coachella Valley. I don't know if you know where that is, but it was just this really, like, super normal, very white, middle-class life that we lived. And because of the neighborhood that we lived in, there wasn't another kid with divorced parents in my school until this other girl transferred into my grade when her parents got divorced. So, like, I didn't know anybody else with divorced parents until I was, like, 10. And I just always felt really different, you know? Like, I went from, you know, like, I don't know. I mean, I guess I didn't even know why I was different. I didn't even understand why I felt differently than everyone else, you know? But at that point, I'd experienced a lot more than the kids, you know, the kids that I knew, the other kids I knew had experienced. And so it kind of left me feeling, and I, you know, it's like the longer you come around, you pretty much hear everyone say, like, it just left me feeling really different from everyone, and that feeling never really left me. And so I started getting into trouble, like, at a really young age. age, you know, and it was just kind of an awkward situation, you know, like I hated my dad for taking me from my mom, and I hated my mom for doing things that made me not allowed to be with her and stuff like that. So, you know, fast forward to, I don't even know how old I was, that it was my first drink, but it was Southern Comfort out of my parents' liquor cabinet. And I don't know why two people working for Polo Ralph Lauren had Southern Comfort in their cupboard, but they did. And it was my first drunk, and I got plowed, and I went to this Super Bowl party at their friend's house. And I don't think anyone knew that I was drunk. And it was like, it was the first time that I drank enough to feel the effects. And the table's making me uncomfortable. And not you guys, just the table. I'm like before we even leave to go to this party, like I forced it into my body, and I thought I was gonna throw up, but I didn't, and I held it down. And you know, it's like, you know, whatever, within minutes I was feeling the effects, and I was like walking around behind our house. We lived up in the Redwoods in La Honda, and I was like walking around, and I like felt like everything was fucking okay. You know, like I was alone, and there was nothing wrong with that for the first time in my life. Because I had always, like, from a very early age, been uncomfortable around other people and felt there was something really wrong with me for being uncomfortable around other people. And so, I mean, that's what alcohol did for me from the beginning. Like, it wasn't any sort of, like, social lubricant for me ever. It just made me really okay with being alone. You know, it was like that, obviously, like those instances became more frequent and closer together. And I remember the first time that, you know, because I never thought of my mother as an alcoholic, but I remember the first time that my dad used that in an argument with me. That was the first time I'd ever heard my mother called an alcoholic. Was we were having a fight, and I don't even know, like, it just came out of left field. He was like, you know your mom's an alcoholic, right? And I was like, well, fuck you, then I am too, you know? And little did we know. you know, it, like, by the time I was 12, like, I'd stopped doing all the cute little, extracurricular activities, you know, like dancing and soccer and horseback riding and all those cute things that little girls like to do. I mean, meanwhile, like, while I'm doing all these things, it's like I was finding my first addictions. You know, my first addictions were, like, movies and sugar and cutting myself. And, like, I was the kind of girl that, like, as soon as I found out who Emily Dickinson and Sylvia Plath were, I started writing poetry. you know, so that was, like, around the time I was 12. Sylvia Plath might have saved my life, oddly enough. And so it was like at school I was still feeling really awkward and left out, and I didn't have any friends, you know, and I spent cigarettes happened really quickly, and so like during my lunch breaks, instead of being like with all of the other people, I would go off and smoke and be alone. Sometimes there were like one or two other weirdos over there with me, but I was pretty much the only weirdo. And so, you know, like, by the time I was 13, I'd started finding ways to get intoxicated, like, pretty regularly. And when I was 14, my father had just had enough. And my mother had moved back to California. And he was like, listen, she's your problem. And so I went and I lived with my mom, and I drank a lot with my mom. And I met a lot of people in the Santa Cruz Mountains to drink with. but it's pretty easy to do. it happened really quickly. Um, But it was like, it always had to be more for me. Like, it always had to be bigger, and it always had to be more and more often and later and earlier. And, you know, it got to the point where, like, I wasn't even welcome in the one-bedroom trailer that I lived in with my mom and her boyfriend, you know. And so I left there, and I had, at that point, I'd started making friends with people. Well, I didn't leave of my own accord. I was kicked out of there. And by then, I had made friends with people who were homeless. And so I was like, let's give this a shot, since I don't really have anywhere else to go right now. And so I did that, and that was, like, really conducive to everything that I ever wanted to do. It was like Neverland, you know, like, never gonna grow up, you know, never gonna have responsibilities, you know, I'm just gonna be drunk for the rest of my life, and hopefully I'll die early. And that's, you know, the other part of my story is that, you know, like, the cutting sometimes was more serious than other times, you know, and that kind of, like, physically self-destructive behavior ceased once I was constantly drunk or high. So I firmly believe that drugs and alcohol saved my life. I would not have survived the first 20 years of my life if I hadn't started getting drunk. And so, you know, obviously, like, being around people that, you know, it's like, I got my first drunky boyfriend at 14. That was exciting. And like, I learned how and where to cop dope before I even started doing it. A couple months after I got kicked out of my mom's house, I got 5150. And I spent a couple days in the hospital and went to Baby's First Rehab at Thunder Road. And I was there for 2 weeks, and I left. Well, I think I was there for a week, and I left once, and then I went back, and then I was there again, and I left with a girl who actually had, like, a destination and people she was going to. And so I went there and hung out with those people with her, and I was introduced to intravenous drugs at 14. That's all she wrote. You know, I was like, this is it. You know, like, this is how I'm going to live, and this is how I'm going to die. You know, and hopefully I die quickly. And so, basically, like, the next 5 years, 6 years of my life were sort of a blur, you know, like, there were times of incarceration, there were a couple times when I was like, maybe this is a bad idea, I'm gonna try and, you know, like, quit this drug by doing that drug, or quit doing drugs and drink only, and, you know, like, all of the things that a homeless junkie tries to do in order to manage their life. You know, and so I followed someone up to San Francisco, and, you know, like, things progressed a lot, you know. It's like the lazy beach town junkie is nothing compared to the city junkie, I guess. and, you know, I was 15, and that was kind of where, like, the incomprehensible demoralization that they talk about in the book happened. You know, like, I learned how to demoralize my demoralization. You know, it just, like, if there was, like, you know, if there wasn't another rung on the ladder, I would dig one. You know, it's like, I would just, I did everything that I said I would never do. And I did it until I was 19. You know, it was like a lot of legal troubles, but for the most part, it was just a lot of me fending for myself. You know, like, doing everything I needed to do, whether it was taking other people's stuff or selling my body or whatever I needed to do in order to stay high and drunk. You know, like, that was just that was. I had created this idea and this like belief that and there was no way in my mind that this could not be true, that like there had to be this balance in the world, right? It's like I was in the city and I was seeing all these people, you know, like people like going to school or going to work or driving cars or holding hands with their partner or eating food or whatever, you know, and it's like rather than being envious of them, I kind of had this belief that like in order for them to go on with their happy little lives like this, there had to be a piece of shit like me at the other end of the spectrum. You know, like, I believed that that was my natural place in life. And I was okay with it, you know? It's like, as long as I was loaded, I really didn't care what the consequences were of my actions. Or I didn't care what actions I had to take in order to stay loaded. And, and so there along the way there were a few times that I sort of got a glimpse of the 12 steps. One of them, when I was 13, I went to a couple of ALATI meetings that I liked a lot because I got to chain smoke. But you know, other than that, like that whole like community thing, I just didn't really dig. Excuse me. And yeah. So, by the time I was 19, you know, I was all the cops knew me, and, so it was starting to get a little bit old. I'd been homeless since I was 14, and I think, probably just starting to get tired. I was tired of the things that I had to do in order to survive, and I was tired of getting arrested. I was tired of being alone. You know, like that was when I knew that it had stopped working. Was that you know, that little magical moment of being okay with hating myself and being alone. And knowing that that was how I was going to be for the rest of my life, that I didn't get that anymore. You know, it's just like every single day, I just got like darker and darker. And so I got arrested one time, and it was like the first time that I had to stay in jail for long enough to like get a pretty clear head. And I was, like, laying on the top bunk staring at the ceiling, thinking, like, there's no way that I'm going to fall asleep, and just thinking way too much. And so for the first time since I was, like, 13, I was sober enough to get suicidal. And I was like, you know, as soon as I get out of here, it's over. It's done. You know, like, I'm over it. I'm over life. It's pointless. Like, there is no other way for me, because I had that belief that, like, there wasn't a better life for me, that like I was not put on this planet, I was not equipped with whatever it takes to function in society, whatever that meant, you know, like I didn't even know what that meant or how it felt. And so I got out, and I guess I got distracted because I didn't kill myself. but I did get arrested again like a week later. And one of the things that I always love hearing about when I hear people share is that mirror moment. I love it when it's like actually a mirror, you know, like when they hit their bottom, when they actually look in a mirror for the first time. But for me, it was this sort of weird kind of existential mirror of like, I was sitting in the pod at 850 Bryant, and I was looking around at all of these women. And I'd been in there for a couple days, and I had just like done the light shampoo thing, and which isn't as bad as the scabies shampoo, so it wasn't really that mad. I was looking around. It was like a meal time or something, sometime when like everybody's out, and there was this like
really diverse crowd of people around me, and some of the faces were really familiar because it was like I saw them on the corner of Jones and Sutter, and then I would see them in 850 Bryant, you know, and then I'd see, them somewhere else, like at the Civic Center in front of Carl's Jr., and then I'd see them in jail. So I had all these like friends now. That's not really how it was, but. I was looking around, there was this one woman that I'd gone through processing with who was like old as dirt. She was like, I don't know how old she was, but she was old and like she was just chilling there for a while in between two women's prisons. Like she was on her way to another one, I don't know why, but like she was like gonna die in prison. And I had talked to her while we were going through processing. And then there was this other chick that was my age, who I had been in juvenile hall with when I was 14 years old, and I had not seen her since then. And she was pregnant. and everything in between there. And so I just had, I guess it was a moment of clarity. I didn't know what a moment of clarity was at the time, but like I looked at these people and I was like, this is it for me. Like if I don't change something, you know, I'm not gonna die, you know, like I'm gonna be 64 in here, you know, like if I don't change something, like I'm gonna die in prison, you know, I'm not gonna be one of those people that's fucking lucky enough to die of an overdose. And that's the way I thought at the time, you know, and so I picked up the phone and I called the last person on this planet who would talk to me. I called my mom. And I was like, hey, I don't know if I'm getting out of here, but if there's any chance that you could help me change my life, that would be awesome. And she's like, well, I'm back in AA and I have 2 weeks sober, so I'll see what I can do for you. And so I did get out. I got out like a week later and I went back to Santa Cruz. It was like the first time somebody had been at jail when I got out to like meet me. So that was kind of cool. That felt good. And I went back to Santa Cruz and I started like my little journey to recovery. And it was really weird, you know, it was like I found a rehab that with like a county sponsored whatever bed that I could go to, and I spent, you know, like a month waiting to go, and my mom took me to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and it was a new meeting at the Santa Cruz Fellowship of AA, and you know, meetings were kind of weird for me at first. When I got to AA, like I still talked to myself and I still smelled funny, you know, and I was still like very much like only like a couch bed above a homeless junkie prostitute, you know, and so I still felt really different because I was surrounded by people that bathed and ate food, and I felt like I wasn't going to be accepted. You know, I felt like there was no, like, I'm just going to sit here and hope that I can do this on my own. And it turns out that I was accepted with open arms into Alcoholics Anonymous. One of the people that helped me the most just died of an overdose a couple weeks ago, and I'm going to his memorial on my sobriety birthday next week. But, you know, it's like the people that were there, it was like no matter how much time they had or how much money they had or how old they were, because most of them were like men over 50, and it's like they brought me like directly into their lives. And they taught me how to eat. They let me chain smoke their cigarettes. You know, they bought me coffee, they suggested bathing, and, you know, I would be sitting there fucking gibbering and jabbering and thinking, you know, like, digging through garbage sounds way more fun than this, but, you know, like, they would totally just sit there and, like, be my friends, and, like, I could not sit through a whole meeting. I took, like, 5 cigarette breaks every meeting I went to, and I went to, like, 3 meetings a day for my first year and a half. You know, one of the things that I've discovered is that growth happens pretty slowly for me, and so it took me a while to sort of, like, even out, and, like, once I, and, like, the big book, are you kidding me? You know, like, I opened that shit up, and I was, like, I would read a sentence, and then I would start the next one and forgot anything that the one before it had said, you know? Like, I couldn't understand the literature when I first got sober. The 12 and 12 was a little bit more digestible. Like, I could kind of handle that. But I found a sponsor who I went to a meeting, and, like, I picked out, like the toughest looking chick that was in there, and she ended up being, like, the sweetest, most spiritual person that I've ever met in my life, and it was, like, a perfect match. You know, I know that doesn't happen for everyone, but it did for me. You know, like, she had done everything that I had done and been everywhere that I had been, but she did it for, like, 20 years longer than I did, you know? And, like, and I don't know. And she had a job and a car, and she was going to get married, and, you know, like, she wanted to make the world a better place, and so she seemed pretty happy, and I was like, well, then maybe that's what I want too, is to lead this normal life. And so I started taking her direction, and she started taking me through the steps, and, you know, as, like, we got to the, like, step 2, and I was like, ugh. Like, I understand the insanity part, you know, because I've been pretty much psychotic for the last 6 years, but, what does that have to do with God? And she was like, well, let's try this. Like, do you understand that you and me sitting here right now is a power greater than you? And I was like, yes. And she was like, so do you believe that maybe taking the steps with me can help keep you sober? I was like, yes. She's like, all right, we're good. And so, you know, she also, like, had 20 pages of writing for every step, which was great for me. Like, not everybody does the steps that way. But, like, I wrote until my fingers bled, you know, the first time I did my steps. And then I, you know, it was funny, like, I was doing it, like, most of my focus was on what was happening in Alcoholics Anonymous. I moved into an SLE. When I moved in, it was a men's SLE. it was like, I was, like, the end of it being a men's SLE. They were going to start having women live there. And so I lived with, like, at any point from, like, 8 to 10 other sober people. And that was nuts. It was insane. Everybody that lived in there was in AA, and it was a crazy place. But I lived there for my first year, and it was, like, magical. Like, and I remember when I first moved out, I got horribly depressed. And I moved into this random place with these random people, and I called my sponsor, and I was like, you know, getting drunk on the beach sounds really good right now. And she told me to go back and read my first step, because obviously I'd forgotten that getting drunk on the beach has nothing to do with getting drunk for me. Nothing. Like, it is not getting drunk on the beach. It's, you know, straight to the flats for me. You know, it's like straight to whatever, you know, whatever the worst possible thing that could happen, you know. And so, like I said, I was, like, putting all this focus into AA, and I guess, like, without even knowing it, I was kind of doing this, it was, like, this weird Fight Club thing, like, I was doing all this stuff outside of AA, like, get my GED and get a job and start going to school and stuff, and, like, I was a year sober before I realized that, like, I had become a member of society, you know, and I was didn't understand it. And the most sense that I've ever been able to make out of it was that, you know, it, like, doing this, like, taking the steps and, like, having service commitments and going to meetings and staying in touch with people and bathing and eating and doing all the normal stuff you're supposed to do. It's, like, stuff over here to keep my hands busy while, like, the man behind the curtain takes care of all this other weird shit, you know, like, stopping hating myself and, I don't know, it's sort of still hard for me to put a grasp on the remarkable change that happened for me in my first couple years of sobriety. You know, I was able to move to another state in sobriety. I spent 4.5 years of my sobriety living in Portland, Oregon. And 5 winters in Portland was enough to bring me back to California. It's pretty unbelievable the way on the outside, honestly, like, I'm really, like, it's so funny, like, they say, like, write down or whatever, like, things that you want out of sobriety when you first get sober, and then, like, a few years later, like, you'll know you'll have so much more than that, and that's totally not true for me. Like, I still don't have a fucking college degree. I don't even have a 2-year degree. I fucking barely make minimum wage. I lived in a moldy apartment in West Oakland. I don't have a car, you know? But it's like I have all this other shit that matters so much more than that, you know? And, I like to believe sometimes, like, left to my own devices, I still believe that I am completely alone in the world, you know, and that's why I keep coming to Alcoholics Anonymous, is because it reminds me that I need to stay in the steps. It reminds me that I need to be a part of this, you know. It reminds me that I am not alone on this planet. There are other people that think the way I do. There are other people that have the same deep-seated, god-awful beliefs that I do, you know, and you know, it's like little by little, very little by little, I hate myself a little bit less every day, you know, and it's been really slow for me, and it's, you know, there have been a lot of weird things for me to come to terms with in AA, you know, like, I still don't believe in God, and so that taken a lot of different, different, like, processes of taking the steps, you know, in order for me to come to terms with the fact that, like, I can be happy and sober and an atheist, you know, and I pray, I do, I pray to thin air, I pray to cosmos, I do, and it feels weird to this day. I just, in December, I was, like, half of November, December, and most of January, I was on step 11, and it was the first time that, like, I had actually, like, tried to do the praying every day thing, and lo and behold, like, I'm still doing it, even though I'm not supposed to be doing it anymore. you know, so self-hypnosis works. It really does. You know, like, I still work with a sponsor really regularly. And I went my first, like, 8 months here without sponsees. Because there are so many people to sponsor. Like, so many more people to sponsor here than anywhere else I've ever been. Like, in Santa Cruz, it's like if you have more than 2 years, you have, like, 5 people ask you a day. But I do, I have, like, a couple sponsees now. One of them is a girl that I sponsored for 4 years in Portland, and she just moved down here, you know? And I don't know, it, like, one of the biggest things that's changed for me is, like, my perspective of what I want my life to be, you know, and my perspective of what I want my life to look like. You know, there are all of these things that I think would make me more comfortable, you know, like having more gainful employment or not getting mold on my boots if I don't wear them for a couple days, because that's how damp my apartment is, you know, that kind of stuff. But what it turns out is that, like, the only thing that is more, like that really, truly I want out of life is people to enjoy it with. Like, the weird poetry writing, Emily Dickinson loving little troll that I was when I was 13 has grown up to be this person that, like, genuinely values other people and, like, genuinely values life, you know? And it's like, I would love nothing more than to devote my life to service, you know? It's another really great reason to stick around AA, because there's lots of it to do around here. Because there are a lot of alcoholics like me that move 5 times a year, you know? You can help your friends move. Or, you know, there's just so much service to be done inside and outside of Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't know, time's running out, and I feel like I haven't really said much, but I don't know. I mean, I guess, like, yeah, like, not being alone in this world, and, like, doing all the things that I need to do in order to have people in my life, you know? And, like, one of the hardest things for me to do take the action before I have the belief. That's been a really big important part, like, my recovery process. I mean, I guess some people call it acting as if, but I heard it pretty early in sobriety, is that, like, sometimes you have to let your feet do the walking and then your heart will follow, you know? And so it's been a lot of, you know, it's just a lot of showing up when I don't want to show up, talking to people when I don't want to talk to people, being sociable when I don't want to be sociable, you know, stuff like that. There's everything that I know about life I learned in Alcoholics Anonymous. Seriously, though, like, everything from, like, my integrity at work to, like, the fact that I keep my living space clean now. Like, I would not have known those things had I not gotten sober, you know? And it's baffling that I've managed to stay sober for 8 years, but it's pretty, like, there's a lot of hope in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know? And that's something that I knew nothing of before I got here. I wasn't raised in a household that, like, involved any sort of positive thinking. And that's something that's become really important to me in my relationships today, is that I'm really attracted to people who have the kind of the hopeful outlook on life, and that really believe in the possibility of, like, realizing dreams, you know, because I didn't even have dreams when I got here, you know. And so I'm babbling. So thanks a lot. And again, big welcome to the newcomers. If you didn't like my share, there's lots of other meetings to go to. You know, and it's like, there are as many ways to stay sober as there are people in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, what one person does to stay sober could kill another person, you know? So it really is, like, while there are only 12 steps, and, like, these are the only steps we have to do, there's pretty clear instructions written in the literature on how to do them, there's still, there's a lot of diversity in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know? And so I truly believe that, like, there's a solution for everyone here, you know, because I had to dig pretty deep to get past some of the surface, like, stuff in the book, you know. So don't be fooled by that stuff. That's it. Thanks.
Okay. I'd like to re-welcome the newcomers and visitors. tonight's speaker, Maddie. Please help me close the meeting with the Serenity Prayer.
Keep coming back to work.